The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
I got no use for professional detachment when it comes to getting inside the skin of our clients, because I was there and I was on fire, and my cross-examination questions were like heat-seeking missiles going pow and finding the target.
Chris Searcy talks about his passion for personal injury practice born from great personal losses.
There were two times that I found myself, you know what, I'm finally getting to represent my little brother. And then another time, you know what, I'm finally getting to represent my son.
And his surprising philosophy on salaries at the major firm he leads.
So I've thought that you have to fairly compensate, and that includes when we get older and less productive, we got to be willing to cut back what we earn.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Chris Searcy grew up in trial practice in Miami, hanging around with legendary lawyers such as Bill Frates, Larry Stewart, Bill Colson, Bill Hicks, and J.B. Spence, to name but a few. As a young law student at Stetson University in 1972, he became involved with the predecessor of the Florida Justice Association, the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers, at an early age, attending seminars and getting early career guidance. And boy, what a career he's had, becoming one of today's legendary trial lawyers. Chris Searcy is a member of the Inner Circle of Advocates, an invitation-only group of 100 lawyers. He's been honored with the Al J. Cohn Award for Lifetime Achievement and the Perry Nichols Award, this association's highest honor. He is a past president of the Florida Justice Association, and the association seminar on voir dire bears his name. But it was two terrible personal tragedies in his life that caused him to gravitate to representing clients in death cases, and is ultimately the passion that fuels his great success as a champion advocate. Chris Searcy sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in July 2018 to talk about his special connection to personal injury law, his advice to rising lawyers seeking lead trial time, and the fine line between hating to lose and being afraid to lose.
Chris, for 43 years, you focused on litigating primarily catastrophic injury and death cases, particularly brain-injured children. You have a special connection to that subject, don't you?
I do.
Tell us about that.
Well, there were two defining moments in my life. One occurred on June 1, 1960. I was a 12-year-old boy riding in the front seat of our family car. My mom was driving all of us back to the beach. We had about eight kids in the car, and that was before anybody had such a thing as a seatbelt or anything. And we were in a new neighborhood dropping off some little kids who'd gone to the beach with us. And there was an intersection with a smaller connecting road, which we were on, and a bigger road is at the corner of Rogero and Fort Caroline Road out near JU. And we're coming across Rogero Road, and they had forgotten to put any signs or lights at the intersection. And all of a sudden, I hear our car speeding up. There's a huge crash, and a big old Cadillac we're in goes spinning like a helicopter, tremendous G-forces. All that sugar sand gets into the air, so we're in a cloud of that where you can't see your hand in front of your face, and we must have spun at least 10 times. We finally come to a stop, and I hear my youngest brother crying and screaming in the back seat. I go over the seat, and he's lying there. He's obviously broken his ankle, and he's lying there screaming. And after a few minutes, Mom comes around, and I said, "I think he's broken his ankle, Mom," and she takes over with him. And I look, and my next youngest brother, Henry, who was 6, and my older sister, Inge, who was 13, they're not in the car, and I go looking for them. And I come across Inge looking like a little baby in a fetal position along the curb. And she's unconscious. And I was a Boy Scout. I'd learned how to take a pulse. I went and felt for her pulse. And she had a pulse. And there were people with her. And she was unconscious. And I looked for Henry, and I saw a group of people standing over in a sugar sand by a telephone pole, and I ran over there, and I come up, and there's my 6-year-old brother Henry lying on his back in the sand. He's got a big hole in his forehead where he crashed into the telephone pole, and his skull was all crushed in, and his eyes were open. They were all glassed over. His teeth were all broken. And he's just lying there on his back, glassed over in this group of people. And I come up and say, "Henry." And when I say his name, his eyes focus on me, and he tries to sit up. And somebody puts a plastic airway in his mouth and pushes him back, and someone else pulls me away from him. And that's the last time I saw my little brother. Fast forward about 13 or 14 years to March 21, 1974. I'm in my first year of law practice in Miami. The wonderful, joyous moment of going in to watch my wife deliver my firstborn son, Henry Falk Searcy II, named after my little brother. Mm-hmm. And I witness what I later learned to be a physician performing a high forceps delivery on Henry, which is verboten in medical practice, and because it brain injures too many children. And Henry gets delivered. They put him over on the table. Some nurses go over there, and the physician sewing up Priscilla's third-degree tear in her episiotomy, and I'm looking over there, and Henry's not breathing, not making any movement, not crying, and they're working on him, and I keep looking, and he keeps getting darker and darker and darker, and he's gets to be the color of this navy blue suit I've got on, and all of a sudden the doctor looks up and sees what's going on and tells the anesthesiologist to leave Priscilla and go over and help with Henry. He goes over and helps, and they continue working on him for a while. It seemed like about an hour before they got him to breathing. It's the best I could reconstruct it in my mind. It was probably about 8 or 9 minutes, but once they got him breathing, he started pinking back up, went to the neonatal unit, but ended up going home after 3 or 4 days as a well child. And we thought everything was going to be good. We never could get him to nurse very well. Had to put him in a bottle, and we kept poking bigger holes in the nipple because he couldn't seem to take the bottle that well. But, you know, as our first child, we didn't know about them, you know, the suck, the importance of suck. We didn't have anything to judge it by. And I guess it was somewhere in his twos. We kept telling the pediatrician, you know, he wasn't talking, and we were concerned. And pediatrician kept saying, well, Einstein didn't talk till he was four and stuff like that. So, in any event, Henry had a little pneumonia, went into the hospital, and it was in for a couple of days. And after that, the pediatrician there spent a little more time with him, and he took us aside and said, you know, Chris and Priscilla, I'm sorry, I haven't been listening to you very well, but there is something wrong with Henry, and I want you to go see this pediatric neurologist. And you know, with your firstborn child, you've got all the hopes and dreams for him in the world. And I will never forget sitting there listening to the pediatric neurologist telling us that Henry will be retarded and will never be a normal child and will need to get special help in waiting for him. And nor will I ever forget the pediatrician telling Priscilla and I, look, you're young. They've got institutions. You can put Henry in an institution and go about with your lives and have other children. And I learned to control my temper.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got to be about 10 or 11 and hadn't hit anybody since about then, but I came awfully close to decking our pediatrician. And you know, I think he meant well, but there was no way that we were gonna ever do anything but be with our child. And
certainly,
we weren't gonna have any more children. We were gonna devote our lives to Henry. And then we slipped up 5 years later and had Christian. Soon realized that Henry was learning more from Christian than he was from us. And fortunately, it wasn't too late for us to have two more after Christian. But so those were two defining moments in my life, two terrible tragedies. And I think they caused me to gravitate towards representing people in death cases. I know very well what it's like to suddenly, unexpectedly, violently, and unjustly lose a loved one. And that is the worst hurt known to mankind. I know what it's like to have a brain-injured, disabled person in your family that demands 24-hour attention and cannot be left alone. And I know the joy of committing one's life to such a person and watching that person have a good life in spite of all those impairments. And I believe those experiences caused me to gravitate to what I do, and have blessed me with the insight to help people. When I would examine what was the silver lining to what happened, you know, it says every dark cloud has a silver lining. I never could figure one out. And I think if there was one, it's the insight it gives us to help others when it happens to them.
Empathy is something that has been stressed by others as such an important quality that a good trial lawyer needs. And it seems like in your case, it's built in, unfortunately, due to your experiences.
I would agree. I think that the case is all about the client. It should be all about the client. And I believe starting with that premise is really the key to my success. I preach to myself on an ongoing basis, listen to your client. He or she is trying to tell you how to win your case. You got to really listen. And despite preaching to myself all the time, I tell all the lawyers in my firm that, listen to your client. Every hour you spend really listening will save you 30 hours of wheel spinning. We got to make the time. We got to listen. And then the second thing is, once we really have listened to them, is to build the case around them, make the case fit them. I think we all have an inclination when we've done real well on some other case to want to use that as our prototype and somehow make this client fit that case.
Because that worked so well in that case.
Yeah, but you know, that's like trying to put a size 12 foot into a size 8 shoe, because that size 8 shoe was a wonderful shoe. And I think really listening to our clients and really preparing our case so that it fits them and their particular situation is just very important. You know, you've got a client that's doing all these things to ruin his or her case, just terrible behavior. And you can try to suppress it, hide it, not talk about it. It's better to really get to know them to find out why. If they've got problems and haven't seen a psychologist or a psychiatrist, help them get to one. Go meet with those folks. Don't wait for deposition. Talk about it. Find out what's going on. And that's usually the key to very poignant damages once you see what it is, because I tell you an example I have, and this goes way back, but I had a case, and it was a wrongful death case. This lady's husband had been killed, and all of a sudden she was going out on the town, drinking all the time, sleeping around with a bunch of different people. And I tell her, I said, look, you know, that's killing your case. You need to respond to things with the truth. They're going to be asking about that. You're killing your case. It didn't matter. All this self-destructive behavior. And so I went and talked with her psychiatrist. It's a guy named McKinley Cheshire here in West Palm Beach. And I said, Dr. Cheshire, she's ruining her case. I said, you know what? Isn't there something you can do? And he was an older gentleman. He said, Chris, I'm going to tell you something, and I want you to listen, because it's very important. And I did listen, and I still remember what he told me. And he said this. He said, the actions of a fish on a hook seem bizarre and without meaning to the rest of the fish in the school, but each movement has precise an exquisite meaning to the fish on the hook. And I listened to that, and I didn't try to hide any of my client's actions. We presented the case and talked about them as her damages and had her specialist explain it. We got a very large verdict, which I don't think would have happened if we tried to somehow gloss over those or minimize those. We needed to make that case fit that client. But, you know, I told you about those two tragedies in my life.
Right.
There were two times that I found myself, you know what? I'm finally getting to represent my little brother. And then another time, you know what? I'm finally getting to represent my son. It was a baby that had been brain injured at birth. It could walk and talk, but not perfectly, like my son Henry. And I get to reading those records and everything, and they're spotless. They're clean. If you read the records, you don't think anybody did anything wrong. They had the defense had the best experts in the land. And I'm reading the records and thinking, you know, this is going to be difficult. But I start seeing some things that don't look quite right. There are things in the record that are inconsistent. And after reviewing the case for a couple of weeks, I reminded myself again, listen to your clients. They're trying to tell you how to win your case. And I hadn't talked to them personally. I had just read their depositions and been reading all these records. So they were out of They were out of state, so I had to get them to come down early for the trial. I sat down and spent the day with them, and by the time I finished spending the day with them, I knew what had happened. The obstetrician had performed a high forceps delivery on that baby, and they lied about it in the records and everything. It wasn't in the records, but with the testimony of the clients and then showing the inconsistencies in the records, the circumstantial evidence of what really happened became overpowering. And that was a case where it was against Bethesda Memorial Hospital, and an obstetrician called Eagleman, and the hospital had made a proposal of settlement, $1,000 for the baby and $1,000 for each parent, for a total of $3,000. The obstetrician had a $250 policy, and he had not offered it until immediately before trial. And we tried that case, and once again, you know, I got no use for professional detachment when it comes to getting inside the skin of our clients, because I was there and I was on fire. And we had the chairman of the greatest OB departments and neurology departments in the United States. They got on the stands, and my cross-examination questions were like heat-seeking missiles going pow and finding the target. We tried that case, and we requested a verdict of $63 million, and the jury returned us a verdict of $63 million.
Wow. That must have been very, very, very satisfying for you.
It was wonderful. It was a spiritual experience for me, each of those cases.
You have had great successes along your years of practicing. At age 29, you were the youngest lawyer at that time to have won a $1 million verdict in a single personal injury lawsuit. How did you go about honing your trial skills?
Well, that's a good question, because, you know, much of my life went into that, and I'm still trying to do it. But if I think back to my senior year in law school, we had a great professor, William McKinley Smiley, later to become Mickey Smiley to me when I knew him on a non-student basis.
Right.
But he taught a senior class, and it was on trial practice, and he would bring in great plaintiffs' trial lawyers, and they'd come and talk to us as lawyers. And I learned a lot from that, and I learned you could get transcripts of their final arguments. And I got those and started reading them, and I was fascinated to see how they were up talking to a jury and they weren't citing cases or going through all of these formalities that we'd learned to do in moot court with appellant arguments. They were talking to people in the language of people, and I knew enough about it that I could see the persuasion going on, and I knew they were having to say what they're saying based on the law and based on the evidence that had been presented in the case, but they were saying it like they were telling a compelling story, and I loved it. And then the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers, which has now morphed into the Florida Justice Association, in 1972 was having its annual meeting and seminar in Tierra Verde, which is a little place near St. Petersburg where Stetson Law School is. And because Professor Smiley was friends with all the leaders in the academy, he got them to invite all of the students in his senior trial practice court to attend the seminar for free.
Wow.
And I went and I listened to Perry Nichols, and I listened to Larry Stewart and Bill Wagner and Tony Cunningham and Fred Levin talking about persuasion. I heard Mo Levine, who had just finished handling a case of blindness, and talking about the abysmal darkness of being totally blind.
Wow.
Going through life in abysmal darkness. But just a So one of the things I did that I do think helped hone my trial skills is I would get lawyers, when they got a real good verdict, I'd get their final arguments, and I'd read them. And I wouldn't just scan through them. I'd read them, thinking as I read them what evidence they needed to present to be able to make that argument, and what jury instruction or case law allowed them to make that argument. Why was it an appropriate rather than an inappropriate argument? That was very helpful in honing my trial skills. And the other thing I found out, and what I like so much about the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers, is the giants of the trial bar back then, Bill Colson, Bill Hicks, J.B. Spence, Bill Freites, all of these guys, you could go up and talk to them, and even though you're a baby lawyer, they'd call you by your first name, treat you like an equal, and talk about your case with you. And it was just fascinating. Back when I'd started out doing mostly defense work, and I can remember I had this plaintiff's case. I was going to get to go try it, and I was defending a case against Stanley Rosenblatt. And we're out in the hallway. I said, "Stanley, I got a plaintiff's case. Can you tell me how you would handle this?" And even though we're trying a case against each other, he stops. He says, "Yeah, Chris, listen, here's what I would do."
Wow.
It was great advice. I ended up following it. I won the case big time, but you could call them up on the phone, and they'd take their time and talk to you, and they still do. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about the, I still call it the Academy, but sure, Now the Florida Justice Association, is that spirit where we're not like the defense lawyers that are all saying bad things about each other because they're trying to get the business from the insurance companies. And even though we are competitors in a way, we not only speak highly of each other, but we try to help each other. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
And you have been heavily involved in the Florida Justice Association in terms of legal leadership roles, a past president, winner of the Al J. Cohn Award, Perry Nichols Award, obviously. Did you have a mentor?
Well, I had a number. Of all the mentors, the one that was most influential on me was my dad, Henry Martin Searcy. Hank Searcy was a plaintiff's trial lawyer in Jacksonville. And he was a very excellent trial lawyer who way back in the 50s was one of the first ones in Florida, other than Perry Nichols, to start getting good plaintiff's verdicts. You know, there had sort of been no such a thing before that. He was a very good trial lawyer. And his lesson to me on voir dire, as he would say, "Chris," and this is after I'd started practicing law, he said, "Chris, you're a good lawyer." And I was doing insurance defense cases. He says, "But I will give you the best case you can imagine, and I'll give you all the time and money you want to prepare that case. And you give me one ringer on the jury, and I'll beat you every time." All right, and I said, "Oh, yeah, okay." So yeah, you got to try to make sure you get the ringers off the jury. You know, the ones that might have a bias in there, you got to get them off. As Aristotle says, the first element of persuasion is the audience. He understood his audience. He knew how thick-headed I was. And he stuck with the lesson throughout his life.
And you, in turn, teach Bordere and other workshop topics at the FJA regularly.
Yes, I do. I don't think everybody's as thick-headed as I was. I think most of them learn a lot faster than I did.
Dad to the rescue.
Yeah.
One of your fellow trial lawyers described you as someone who, if they don't get full value for a settlement, will go to court and they'll try the case. How important is that?
Well, I don't think that the adversaries will respect your clients if they don't know that you will do that. And back when I did insurance defense work, which I did for a little while, believe me, the insurance companies and the defense lawyers keep good notes on who will go to trial and who won't. And I think that a fair settlement in the hand for a client is usually a better deal than a potentially big verdict in the bush, because cases can also be lost or bad results can be obtained. So if they offer you enough money that it doesn't make sense for your client to refuse it, that's one thing. If the offer is not what it should be, and you, because it's too much effort, too much trouble, you're going to have to lose sleep and not see your family for a week, miss what you were going to do on the weekends or whatever, that's what I think we should not give in to. I started with a plaintiff's firm, and then I was hired away from that firm by an insurance defense firm, a gentleman by the name of Bob Montgomery, who was also one of my important mentors. And I think one of the most important things that Bob taught me was show me a lawyer that hadn't lost any trials, and I'll show you a lawyer that's settling too easy.
Do you still get nervous before a trial?
That's a good question, and I get nervous as hell before every trial. Still today,
really?
I've tried cases for 45 years. I've probably tried more jury trials than most human beings in the world, and I still get scared to death. Every time I'm getting ready for a trial where it's a trial that where I can't, no matter how hard I prepare, I can't control all of the variables because I got a real smart defense lawyer on the other side trying to trip me up every step of the way. I think to myself, you know, is this going to be the time when everybody figures out how stupid you really are? So I think the fear of that causes me to prepare real hard. But I do want to say this. It's not so much about loving to win as it is hating to lose. I think I hate to lose worse than anybody I know. And the problem with hating to lose is there's only a very fine veil that separates that from being afraid to lose. And so I think about it all of the time, because I don't ever want to cross over to where my hating to lose makes me afraid to lose, and where I settle a case for less than I should have or give in on something I really shouldn't because I'm afraid to lose.
Chris, you're president and CEO of a firm that is one of the largest personal injury law firms in Florida, 29 lawyers, more than $5 billion in won verdicts and settlements, many, many accolades, very many famous cases. What are the secrets of your day-to-day success in this very tough profession, both as a lawyer but also as head of a firm?
All right. Well, I never went to school or took any courses on how to manage a business, which managing a firm is like managing a business. So I don't consider myself to have any real expertise in that other than on the job. But what I have found, because I sort of morphed into being the head of a big firm. I started with a big firm, got hired away from that by another, and I say big firm, big for the personal injury, wrongful death, litigation type of firm. And I found myself running and leading a firm, and what I believe is that as far as a firm goes, number one, when I hire a lawyer, I want to get good people. I want every lawyer I hire to end up being one of the shareholders and partners. I want to get people that can run the firm one day to start out and work for me. And good people. But the second thing is, I think the whole key to making it all work is to fairly compensate people. That's hard to do, even if you're committed to doing it. It's hard to do. But if you can figure out how to fairly compensate everybody and stay true to that principle, then no matter how badly you screw up the rest of the stuff, it's going to work anyway. And if you can't get that right, then no matter how well you do the rest of the stuff, it eventually is not going to work. I loved all of these guys that were the legends of the trial lawyers in Florida when I started out. You know, they were my friends. I knew about them. They were my mentors, my idols. And all of their firms, they got older. All of the firms started dissolving or breaking up, and it wasn't going beyond them. And I thought to myself, you know, that's not right. Why is that? Why can't, instead of it being a wonderful run and then it's all over, why can't we, the people that are now in their prime and running things, why can't we be like a stage of a rocket that's being a booster for the next generation of people in our firm, and let them start off from a higher atmosphere and you know, get to the areas of space we never got to. And so I started thinking about all of that, and fair compensation was one of them. I think probably what happened a lot was people who were always getting the lion's share of all of the income because they were the lion's share of the production. As time wore on, some of the younger people started producing more, but the compensation didn't change. And so I've thought that you have to fairly compensate, and that includes when we get older and less productive, we got to be willing to cut back what we earn.
Interesting point.
But I think probably something that has helped me succeed as an advocate more than anything else is I want to make sure I can convince myself of something before I try to convince anybody else. If I can't convince myself, and I'll try to be critical, and well, what about this, what about that? If I can't convince myself of something, then I don't want to go out there and try to convince somebody else. And if I've got a case and here's what I want to convince somebody of, and no matter how hard I try based on the evidence and law, I can't convince myself of that, then I finally admit to myself, this is going to be a point I need to gracefully succeed, and I need to find another avenue or another theme to succeed with that case. And I've tried to never go into trial and convince others of anything I can't convince myself of. But when you've convinced yourself and you really believe in it, that sophisticated audience can see that you do. And that zeal and power of belief you have in the case is a very strong, nonverbal, persuasive factor.
Chris, you hear about lawyers going to a law firm and they've been there 7, 8, 10 years. They have never been in trial, haven't been the lead counsel. What advice would you have for someone in that situation?
All right. Well, this... And I think it's gotten harder and harder to get into trial and try cases as lead counsel. What I would do, and it worked, what I would do is I would get the case, and I wouldn't talk to insurance adjusters or defense lawyers or anything. I'd get the case, and I would investigate it as best I could without having subpoena power. I'd go out and you know, look at the scene, get the measurements, do everything I could, go out myself and talk to the witnesses, talk to my clients, go get a conference with their treating doctors, learn everything I could about that case without having discovery power from the defendant. And then I'd get with my client, sit down with my client and say, all right, here's what I want to do. I want to evaluate your case with you and tell you all the things we have to prove, the evidence we can present, and talk about what we would settle this case for, what would be the least we're ever going to settle this case for, and offer to settle for that up front. Because if we're going to eventually settle for an amount this low, then at least you won't have all these costs coming out of it. And I would file suit And under our proposal for settlement back rule, back then it was an offer judgment rule, but you can 90 days after the complaint served on the defendant, you can send them a proposal of settlement. So I wouldn't say boo to the other side. I wouldn't have any settlement negotiations. I'd work the case up. I'd file suit. It was the first time they saw it. I'd be waiting 90 days to send out an offer of settlement for the lowest amount that I know my client is ever going to take on that case. And I knew from my insurance defense work, they're never going to pay that. If that's your first offer, they're never going to pay it, at least not unless you're on the doorsteps of the courthouse or getting ready to try the case. What they don't know that you know is once it gets to the doorsteps of the courthouse, you're not going to take anything close to that anymore. So now you wait 90 days and make that offer, and you've got your time clock running. They're going to have to pay you by the hour for all of your attorney's fees in this case when you get more than 125% of the amount you offered to settle for. And so even if you've ended up spending more time and effort than the verdict would be worth, you're going to get paid well in your motion for prevailing party attorney's fees by beating this proposal of settlement. And so, but then the other thing I found out is once you've done that five or six times and you make this first offer and never go below it, and then you get these big verdicts, is I think I had mentioned somewhere earlier that from my defense lawyer days, I know that insurance companies and adjusters and defense lawyers keep immaculate notes on who's going to go to trial and who's going to run like a rabbit when the case gets close to trial. And so after I'd done that about five or six times, I had these insurance adjusters calling me up, say, "Chris, you know, we're trying all these cases and we don't need to do that. Let's you and I have lunch and talk about the cases we got and see if we can't settle them early, save you a lot of trouble." But for lawyers who haven't made a name for themselves and are getting cases, some of which I'm sure if they're a new lawyer and their law firm's letting them go out and try the case as lead counsel, it's not the biggest mess win in the law firm. What they can do that I think will allow them to try the case and get them to become recognized as a trial lawyer is to do that real good pretrial preparation, file the case, wait 90 days from service of process, make that demand that's going to be the least your client will ever take. They'll get to try them. They'll get to beat the proposals of settlement. They'll get court-awarded attorney's fees, and they'll be off to a good start.
Good advice. What's your view on the future of the legal profession? Do you have any concerns?
I have great concerns. I have great concerns about the future of the legal profession because it seems that, you know, the legal profession was one of the only professions that had remained independent. The medical profession had remained independent for a long time, but representing doctors, because when I did my insurance defense work, I did a lot of medical malpractice defense, and I saw all of them that had always managed their own firms and managed their bookkeeping and their billing of clients and everything, had these insurance companies saying, "Look, you're too important. What you do is too important. Let us take care of all this. We'll handle all the billing of the clients, and they won't be fussing at you because we're the ones that will be paying the bills anyway." And they romanced them and got them all to turn over all of the business side of the interrelation with the patients to them, and the doctors were no longer in control of it. And once the insurance industry gained control of the patients, they began asserting more and more rights and taking more and more rights away from the physicians, which is very largely the case now. So, you know, wait a minute, you guys work for us. You know, you do what we want to, or we're taking the patient somewhere else. So I'm worried that's happening with the law. to our credit, the bars in every state, the American bars, are fighting very hard to maintain the independence of the legal profession and to maintain the division of powers, the third of which is supposed to be the judicial system, and have it remain independent and have the lawyers practicing within it remain independent. But it's harder and it's harder and it's harder. You've got multinational corporations with the wealth of small countries that do not want us to have any independence, because if we have any independence, we're too big of an inconvenience or a threat to them. I think, to our credit, when I say our, I'm talking about the courts and the lawyers within the justice system, I think we're aware of the importance of our profession, the independence of our profession and our third branch of power, and we're fighting to maintain that independence.
And that's certainly something that has been uppermost on the agenda of the Florida Justice Association as well.
It certainly has.
We've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
I don't think that we ever ought to lie. I don't think that we ought to ever cheat. I remember way back in my early practice, I'd got a plaintiff's case. It was a decent plaintiff case. And I had I can't remember exactly what the format was, but there was something, and it was evidence, and I thought it was going to hurt my case, but it wasn't protected by work product or anything. And I got, I guess it was a request to produce that had fairly requested what it was that I had, and there wasn't a good reason for me not to turn it over. I think that I had one theory and made an objection, which the court properly overruled. And, you know, I was thinking nobody would ever know if I'd just deep-sixed that. And I thought about it. I thought, you know what? If I do that, what wrong thing wouldn't I do? And I didn't do it. But I think that was a time when I thought, gee, that's going to hurt my client, and nobody would know. And did I think that the ends justified the means? No, I didn't. And I turned it over, and with a little good lawyering, it ended up not hurting the client anyway.
Chris, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, I don't know that there's any importance to my being remembered. I think what I would hope to have accomplished is I hope that I would have made a big difference in a lot of people's lives, people who, for no fault of their own, have had their lives absolutely ruined, where I was able to be a significant help and give them a better life and a better future. As far as my colleagues and friends in the legal profession, just being a stage of the rocket, and my experience and the things that I've learned and that I've achieved being something that helps my younger friends and colleagues achieve heights that I was never able to, and that's what I would like to have achieved professionally.
Chris Searcy, you are a Titan of Trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.